This week on the Best of Flashpoint, a report from Lebanon on the border skirmish between Israel and the Lebanese army on the fourth anniversary of the war there, and sounds from the Kent State Truth Tribunal, plus a lot more. Stay tuned.
In Berkeley, I'm Dennis Bernstein. You're listening to Flashpoints on Pacifica Radio. At least three Lebanese and one Israeli soldier. Soldiers have been killed during an exchange of rocket and gunfire along the border between the two countries. A journalist was also killed and four more Lebanese soldiers wounded by Israeli shelling on Tuesday. The Israeli army did not say how the Israeli soldier was killed. We go to Lebanon. We're joined by an old friend of this broadcast who helps us sort things out when it comes to situations like this, Bilal El Amin. He is, well, where exactly are you now, Bilal?
I'm in Beirut right now, Dennis.
All right. First of all, give us your understanding on the ground there in Beirut. What has been going on? How did this encounter or this little battle get triggered?
Well, apparently what happened was that Israeli military wanted to remove a tree that happened to be on the Lebanese side of the border, and also to place a camera for surveillance of the adjacent village, which is the village of Adaisi, where the battle took place today. And basically, from what we're hearing, is that they did put a request in through UNIFIL, the UN forces that are on the ground in southern Lebanon, to the Lebanese army asking to do this. The Lebanese army refused, so the Israelis ignored that decision completely and proceeded to try to cut down the tree and post the camera. And the Lebanese army, probably to the surprise of the Israelis, actually fired at them after warning them, of course, and prevented them. So there was an exchange of fire that escalated very quickly. And as you said, there were two Lebanese soldiers that were killed and several injured, as well as a Lebanese journalist who was also unfortunately killed. From what we're hearing, an Israeli officer was killed, and a few other soldiers, Israeli soldiers, were injured. And then after intermittent fight back and forth, it ended in the late this afternoon.
Looking at some of the commentary coming in through Al Jazeera, and the commentators there are calling this a very significant encounter, and it's not out of the blue, is it?
Well, there's some controversy about exactly why the timing, what was it all about. Some people are saying that this was an isolated incident, that perhaps the Israelis didn't think that the Lebanese army would actually defend their own land, their own border, which has actually been the history, unfortunately, of the Lebanese army before. But there's another side saying that this was a sort of test on the part of the Israelis, one to see how the Lebanese army will behave in such a situation, because the Lebanese army was only deployed in southern Lebanon along the border only after the July 2006 war. So their presence there is new to the Israelis, and they were trying to test what these soldiers were made out of and to what extent they're going to actually confront the Israelis. The other question was what Hezbollah, the resistance, would actually do also in this kind of situation. So the idea was that this was kind of to test the different forces, maybe in preparation for a war that everyone expects will break out sooner or later, where Israel is going to try to sort of redeem itself after the big failure in 2006.
Well, what is the word from Hezbollah? What are they saying about this?
Near coincidence, the Secretary General of Hezbollah was scheduled to speak. It's basically right now is the fourth anniversary of the July 2006 war. So he was speaking, but actually the subject was not supposed to be this what took place today. The subject, and that's been a big issue here in Lebanon, is the tribunal for the former prime minister, the international tribunal for the former prime minister, Rafiq al-Hariri, looking into his assassination. And Hezbollah basically came out about 2 weeks ago saying that they have very good information saying that they're going to be accused of the assassination by this international tribunal. In any case, Nasrallah was supposed to speak on that issue. He did speak some on that issue because they basically view it as just another way of another means of getting at them by the Israelis, and it certainly appears that way. And instead, he also ended up speaking, also obviously commenting on the events of today. And basically, all he said, and usually in they're quite clever at handling these kinds of delicate situations, but he said our position was that we were prepared for everything. Our fighters were ready in the villages right near where these events were taking place. But they put their fighters under the command of the army, because the Lebanese army was the one carrying out the confrontation. And it was basically up to them to either ask the resistance to jump in or not. And in the end, they didn't. But he basically said that in the future, we're not going to sit by and watch Lebanese soldiers get massacred in the way that they did. And certainly, if it escalated today, you probably would have seen, this is why it was so dangerous, probably, is that it could have escalated into something much bigger very quickly.
You're listening to Flashpoints on Pacifica Radio, and we are speaking with an old friend of this broadcast, Bilal El-Amin. He is in Beirut, Lebanon. There was a little encounter at the border today. Several Lebanese soldiers died, an Israeli soldier. A journalist was killed. A number of other people were wounded. Ironically, maybe, who knows, the fourth anniversary of that Israeli war that was incredibly punishing to Lebanon. You yourself covered that, were working as a translator, were on the front lines, did some wonderful commentary, important commentary for this broadcast. So here it is, almost to the day, 4 years. Talk about, just that coincidence, if you will, and also remind people about what happened, and just very briefly, has there been any reparations? Has there been a recovery from that incredibly punishing attack by Israel?
Unfortunately, very little has come from Israel's side, but I think the repercussions of the war have been quite huge politically, and that what we've seen happen in the past 4 years, because of what was basically a clear victory for the Lebanese resistance, it basically undid the whole U.S. Plan for the region. I mean, this was the July 2006 war was basically the sort of opening shot in the what was what Condoleezza Rice called the New Middle East, and basically that was trying to redraw the map, essentially get rid of all opponents of U.S. and Israeli policy in the region. That would include Syria, the Syrian regime, other resistance groups like Hamas, and of course Iran. And this was the opening shot in the war, that Israel was supposed to go in and just clean up the Hezbollah resistance in the south. And instead, what we had was the very opposite. Israel basically had to cry uncle after pushing to extend the war for a full month, carrying out a very ferocious, nasty war. I mean, one of the things that Nasrallah reminded us today of was that about the situation with the cluster bombs that were launched in the hundreds of thousands, just in the last day of the war. And those, by the way, came from the U.S. in the last week of the war. They were rushed to Israel. In any case, we still have close to a million cluster bombs spread throughout the South, and they've only been able to clean up, despite very hard work, they've only been able to clean up 200,000, according to Nasrallah's figures.
And just staying with that for a moment, a million of these cluster bombs that were really are declared in under international conventions to be illegal anti-personnel weapons used against civilians. And of course, they are the kinds of weapons that continue to blow up unsuspecting kids and families on their way to picnics. Are these bombs, is there a record of these cluster bombs still scattered, still killing people?
He also gave some figures about how many killed so far. Obviously, throughout the period after the war, there's been a steady stream of deaths. I think they've reached 44 at this point. But the part that we don't hear about is the injuries. Obviously, the cluster bombs, most of the time, when they're near someone or they're stepped on or they drop from a tree or something, they usually injure quite severely, meaning that a person would lose a leg or a hand or one of their something like that. And in this case, there are thousands. I think he mentioned 7,000 such injuries have taken place in the past 4 years as a result of this. So it's quite massive. And what's frightening is that it takes so much time to actually remove these. We're talking 4 years, and this has been a number of outfits been working virtually around the clock trying to clear these cluster bombs, and they've only cleared 200,000. There's a million, and this is in addition to the hundreds and maybe thousands of mines that were left behind since the Israeli occupation, which ended in 2000. There's still a lot of those left behind.
The landmines that the Israelis never did turn over the maps to, because they have a good idea of where all those landmines are, don't they? But they didn't turn over any information.
Exactly. They do, and they even have, they're able to give certain kinds of maps for the cluster bombs as well. The mines are more specific because they plant them there, but with the cluster bombs, they can actually give a sense of where the areas they bombed with the cluster bombs, so you can know a general area where these exist, and of course, they haven't turned those over. And generally, the tensions are pretty high in the region. I mean, a lot of Hezbollah and a lot of sort of more astute observers of the situation are saying that we're not on the verge of war, certainly. But we had the president of Syria yesterday, on August 1st, make a speech where he said, there's danger of war. The Israelis have been talking about war a lot and threatening a lot. So the area is fairly tense, and a lot of people think it has to do with what's going on in Palestine. And essentially, and this is quite unfortunate and disappointing of the Obama administration, but essentially it's trying to strong-arm the Palestinian Authority. Not that it requires a lot of strong-arming, but they're trying to strong-arm them into another round of fruitless negotiations with the Israelis and maybe even impose a really awful settlement on the Palestinians. And basically, when something like that is going on, there's a lot of other files that are connected to it that have to be dealt with. And Hezbollah and really sort of pressuring the resistance, whether it's Hamas, Hezbollah, Syrians, or anyone who is opposed to the sort of endless, fruitless negotiations, they put a lot of pressure on them so that Abbas can perhaps come to an agreement or at least sit down with the Israelis. in some way, shape, or form. So a lot of it may very well have to do with what's going on in Palestine, although it may not appear so.
All right. Well, we all know that at the core of peace and real justice in the Middle East is the rights of the Palestinian. And they, one way or another, you track it back. Somehow it ends up right there. But a lot more to say on all of this. Bilal El-Amin, thanks for talking with us on this. I guess it's close to exactly the fourth anniversary. The tensions are high. Shootout at the border. People died again. We're going to watch it very closely. Again, we thank you very much for the good information and your time.
Of course, Dennis. Anytime. Thank you.
In Berkeley, I'm Jesse Strauss. You're listening to Flashpoints on Pacifica Radio. Federal Judge Vaughn Walker struck down the California Voter Initiative Proposition 8, saying that the law is unconstitutional under due process and equal protection clauses. Prop 8 is the law that makes same-sex marriage unconstitutional in California. Therefore, under California state law, same-sex couples would be able to marry. Soon afterward, however, the same federal judge who overturned Prop 8 issued a stay on the ruling, meaning that the same-sex couples in California will not be able to marry until further notice. Joining us now to talk about the long-term meaning of the ruling is Leland Trayman. Leland is a long-term activist in the Bay Area gay community. Thank you so much for being with us, Leland.
Thank you.
First, we want to celebrate the fact that a constitutional ban on gay marriage is illegal according to today's ruling. Leland, can you give us your initial response?
Well, yes, this is very nice. We should mark this and be happy. We can raise a glass. Let us not be irrationally exuberant over it. This is one ruling by one judge in a very long road. One of the things missing, significantly missing from this ruling, is any mention of the Defense of Marriage Act passed by the United States government. And so this, if it were to be upheld, if this were to go forward, we could get married in the state of California. But, you know, same-sex marriage, as it is presently constituted, and domestic partnerships have no legal difference. And
under federal law, you mean?
Under federal law. And what we're really looking for is full equality. What I call true marriage equality. Marriage equality is not defined by the fact that it's called marriage. Marriage equality is defined by the fact that we have all the rights of marriage. So Massachusetts, as of July 8th, for the first time, has what I would call marriage equality, because a much more significant ruling happened on July 8th of this year in Massachusetts, where a federal judge threw out the Defense Against Marriage Act. Now, that affects federal law. Unfortunately, that ruling only covers the state of Massachusetts. And I think that is much more significant than what happened today in California. Yes.
Leland, for our listeners, can you first describe just what is the Defense of Marriage Act? But also, it seems to me that it's interesting that it's a federal judge that has overturned Prop 8, but it's also according to federal law that the Defense of Marriage Act is not allowing people to have the same equal rights.
Yes, that's specifically why I find this ruling a little troubling and curious. The Defense of Marriage Act is a federal law that says that any state may pass a law prohibiting marriage in their state if they want, and that the federal government will not recognize same-sex couples, be they in domestic partnerships, marriages, civil unions, no matter what. So, in fact, up until July 8th of this year, marriage in Massachusetts and domestic partnerships in California were pretty much the same thing in terms of rights and responsibilities. And what is more important than what we call these rights and responsibilities, whether it's marriage or domestic partnership or whatever, is having all of them. And here is a federal judge saying that a state law is unconstitutional because it discriminates against lesbians and gay men, but then does not throw out, as the Massachusetts judge did, the Defense of Marriage Act.
And just so we're clear, this federal judge does have the power to throw out the Defense of Marriage. Is that
right? He's in exactly the same position as the federal judge that did this in Massachusetts.
And do you think that there's any hope that that can happen as a next step towards equality, towards marriage equality?
I would hope so, but you know that there's a problem with going through the courts right now. David Bowes and Ted Olson are pursuing this through the courts, and the state of Massachusetts is pursuing this through the courts. And this is all predicated on some pretty shaky ground. And the ground is, one, that all four liberal judges on the Supreme Court will vote in favor of gay marriage, and that they will be able to convince Anthony Kennedy, the one swing vote on the Supreme Court, who has written some very, very pro-gay decisions, quite frankly, but has stopped short on the issue of marriage. They're banking that they will be able to convince him so that we have the five votes we need on the United States Supreme Court. That's pretty scary that's the strategy, that we only have this one judge, justice, that we can influence to our side. The alternative strategy is that one of the conservative five Catholic men on the United States Supreme Court who Anthony Kennedy is part of that block frequently, that one of them will die or leave the court in some fashion, and that President Obama will be able to replace that justice, giving us a much clearer majority on the court. Antonin Scalia is in his 70s. He's overweight, so these things can happen. But until we get a better court majority, I mean, the idea of going forward to what eventually will be to the United States Supreme Court is pretty frightening to me.
So, Leland, I wanted to ask you, it sounds like the picture is pretty dismal. What can we hope for? Is there anything in terms of gay justice that we think can be passed successfully to greet equal rights? And also, on that note, there has been a stay on that ruling.
Yes, issued by Judge Walker himself. What can we do? Well, for a couple decades, we had a very progressive movement that was working for the marital rights. And indeed, President Obama ran on a platform saying that he supported full marital rights for same-sex couples in legally recognized unions, whether those unions were marriage or domestic partnership or civil unions, and that would be marriage equality, all of the rights of marriage, regardless of title. But we need to start focusing on the rights of marriage rather than this obsession with the word and what I call the rights, the marital rights, of marriage. I mean, the word is not as important as the rights. My husband and I have been together for 20 years, and I call him my husband, although we're technically registered domestic partners. No one can stop me from referring to him as my husband. He is my husband. We have two kids, ages 5 and 10, and I am much more concerned with Social Security benefits. I'm much more concerned with us being able to file joint income tax than I am a officially, and I don't care about what those officials say, those officials label my relationship with him a marriage or not. What I want is the rights. I want equal rights. I don't care what they're called.
Well, thank you so much, Leland. I'm sorry we're running out of time, so we're going to have to leave it right there. You're listening to Flashpoints on Pacifica Radio, and that's the voice of Leland Trayman speaking about today's ruling on Proposition 8. Thank you so much, Leland.
Thank you.
And you are listening to Flashpoints on Pacifica Radio. I'm Dennis Bernstein. In San Francisco this weekend, filmmaker Michael Moore continues taking testimony for the Kent State Truth Tribunal, which began its investigation into the attack on students in Ohio 40 years ago. On May 4th of 1970, National Guard troops opened fire, and I know you know this, on Vietnam War protesters, killing 4 students and wounding 9 others. This act changed many of our lives. In one moment, we're going to be joined by 2 of the producers of the tribunal on the ground here, taking testimony over the weekend in San Francisco. But let's listen to some of the sound that was recorded in Ohio at the tribunal.
Sunday, I was on campus. I lived in the dorm. So I was present Sunday and got up in the morning and saw the troops deployed at every major building around the campus and walked around and saw them, and they were friendly, and they were, I think, not really happy to be there necessarily, but they were talking with the co-eds particularly. But there were like half tracks on the campus and jeeps and men with weapons and helmets, and it was like the Vietnam War had come to Kent State. And although I had protested the war, at this point the focus was kind of changed from protesting the invasion and occupation of Southeast Asia and the Southeast Asian country Vietnam to the occupation of our campus. And for me, the idea had changed from an anti-war demonstration to, you know, what do you mean? We have 900 troops here, and we're supposed to go to classes as usual. I'm the oldest of 8 kids in our family, and I was the first one to attend college. My parents couldn't afford to help me, so the money that I earned through high school was how I was paying my tuition. And so for me, to have the National Guard present was interfering with my goal, which was to get educated and get a degree.
And I saw them start to walk up the hill. So I sort of followed along behind them, staying a nice safe distance, I thought. Being a farm boy, when you see somebody with a weapon, you have to assume one thing, and that is that the weapon is loaded. So I knew that the weapons were loaded. I mean, that was just fact number one about any weapon. And so when they marched up the hill, I was sort of plodding along behind them. I had gone onto the practice football field and veered to my left a little bit because I didn't want to be right in front of them, and I didn't want to be close to them. I thought 100 yards was a good safe distance. Being an athlete, I knew what 100 yards looked like. And when I saw them reach the top of the hill, they just wheeled around, lowered their weapons in one smooth motion, and started firing. And I thought, oh my God, they're going to shoot at us. And they were shooting at us, and I jumped on the ground, covered my head, and I could hear bullets hitting the ground around me. And I'm thinking, why are they shooting at me? I wasn't even close to them. I'm off to their right, if you look at where they are, where I am. And I thought I was not, it shouldn't have been in their line of any fire at all. And then I got hit. The bullets were still hitting the ground around me. And I was praying I wouldn't get hit again, because it's a pretty terrifying feeling to have rounds hitting the ground right around your head and your body and not being able to do anything about it. And it was just very scary, very scary. I was probably the most frightened I've been in my life. And then the shooting stopped, and I thought, oh my God, I didn't get hit again. And then someone came to me, asked me who I was, and I gave them my parents' phone numbers, and they were able to reach my parents by telephone before they turned their phones off on campus. So, and then they eventually came and picked us up.
I remembered when I walked over, there was a green medical truck sitting over by the student union that had a big Red Cross on it. So I immediately ran over there, and the guardsmen were just, there were some guardsmen standing around it, and I went to the person who looked in charge. Some pictures later, I'm pretty sure it was General Del Corso. I ran up to him. I said, I'm a faculty member. Students have been shot over there. You've got to send over medical help. He said, we can't send over medical help. We have to save them in case our troops are shot. I said, but they're laying on the ground bleeding. And I said, he said, lady, I don't care who you are. You better get out of here or I'm going to have you arrested. And I walked back across to the other side where the students lay bleeding, and they laid there for, I don't know, after 15 minutes, a stretcher came and took Jeffrey Miller away. He was probably killed right away. Everybody knew he was dead, but we thought he was the only one. And the students lay on the ground for, it was at least 30 minutes before any medical help came, and there they were right there, 1 minute away, and they wouldn't come over to help them. And, you know, as the years have passed, the more I think about that event, if the shootings were an accident, you know, when you've tried to minimize the damage, you know, all four of those students might not have died if someone had come over right away and stopped the bleeding. But they did nothing. I mean, if you have an accident and hurt somebody, I mean, you try to help them unless you had wanted the accident in the first place. And so finally the ambulances came, and all the students who were wounded students were taken away, and everyone was shell-shocked. And we walked back around to the commons where it all started, and just sat down, you know, and a few people were getting up making remarks, and Glenn Frank, a chemistry professor, had gone up to tell. Oh, no, we looked up. So we're sitting there, and I looked up, and you could see the silhouettes of the guardsmen lined all around us, single file, with their guns and bayonets pointed up in the air. And I was just going to sit there as a peaceful, just in protest. And Glenn Frank, the chemistry professor, ran up to General Canterbury and begged him to have the soldiers put their guns down, and he said, we're going to use them if they don't get out of here. And Glenn Frank said, give me 5 minutes. He said, I'll give you 5 minutes, and then we're going to fire again. And he comes running down the hill in front of the crowd, and he was an elder professor. He wasn't that old, but he was older than me. And he had tears running down his eyes. And he said to the students, he said, if you've never listened to anyone in your entire life, you have to listen to me now. And he said, you have to leave here immediately or they're going to shoot you all. And he collapsed right there on the field. And some students ran and helped him up and sort of helped him get off the field. And we all just got up and followed him up. And I think if he hadn't done that, he would not tell me how many might have been killed. And, you know, everything changed after that. I don't know, you know how much. Well, you know, you just had to do something after having been through that. So I was one of four people who signed the papers to form the Kent Legal Defense Fund. There's two faculty and two students to raise money because 25 people were indicted for the guardsmen murdering the students. They indicted 25 people, 24 students, and one faculty member, Tom Loft, sociology professor, what his crime was. He had talked to students afterwards about how terrible what had happened. But with the situation back then, they thought they were going to go away to prison for a long time. And Bill Kunstler was an angel who came in and organized the defense, and so that through the couple years of work, they finally dropped the charges, you know.
Yeah, the Cincinnati Enquirer said three students dead. They didn't even have four students. And from then on, I mean, it was just one thing after another about how the students caused this to happen, that there were bricks being thrown, there were rocks being thrown. And I ask anyone to walk the Kent State campus right now, and where do you see bricks and where do you see rocks? I mean, they just weren't there. And so when I heard all, you know, people that I knew tell the events of what happened and to see photographs, I just always felt in my heart that these rumors that had been started about a sniper, that the students were armed, that wasn't true. And then, I mean, if anybody had known Allison, I mean, Allison was the kind of girl that you would want your daughter to be friends with. She was so nice. She was so intelligent. She was so beautiful. You look at pictures of her and you can see the kind of girl that she was. And for rumors to come out about her that were not true about her character, about her health, was incredibly painful because I knew her and I loved her. And it was very hard for me, and it still is.
Those were excerpts from the Kent State Tribunal. The Kent State Truth Tribunal is going to be in San Francisco taking more testimony, and then it's going to be moving to New York City in the fall. And we thought it would be very important to tell you about it. Maybe you've got some testimony, stories that nobody has ever heard before. They're going to be in San Francisco. We're going to tell you more about that and how you can learn more, how you can listen. You can listen on the internet. And I guess I should tell you that the voices you heard were Joe Lewis, Dean Keller, Nancy Rogers, and Bonnie Henry, last speaking about the killing of Allison Krauss. Two of the producers of this Kent State Truth Tribunal are in the studio. One of them is the sister of Allison Krauss, Laurel Krauss, and Emily Kunstler is also in the studio. She is the producer of Disturbing, William Kunstler, Disturbing the Universe. Thank you both for coming in.
It's a pleasure.
And I want to start with you. It's 40 years, right? 40 years. And it's still, all of us are crying listening to this. You want to just give us a little bit of a memory or reflection of your sister and how you found out about this tragedy?
Well, it is 40 years, and it hasn't healed. And that's one of the reasons why we decided, Emily and I, to create the Kent State Truth Tribunal. We felt it was important for the truth to come out. Basically, in situations like this, where there's post-traumatic stress, where there's a horrible situation that happens, truth-telling is regarded as one of the best ways to heal. And we've integrated that into our project, where people can come. We have venues. We had one at the 40th. It was at Kent State in Ohio at the university over the 40th anniversary, which was May 1, 2, 3, and 4.
That's when the murders took place.
In 1970. And so fast forward to 2010, and my mother actually was there too, Doris Krauss, and a lot of family, a lot of wounded students, a lot of physically wounded students, a lot of students that were also psychically, or however you want to call it, wounded, came and shared their truth, and we recorded it. And so now the stories are preserved. They weren't before. There are other elements, other oral histories and going on, and et cetera, but this is where people can come together and we can create a collective truth.
Emily Kunstler's in the studio. I think about the sort of environment that was created around this killing to justify
the murders of these kids who were shot unarmed on campus. It was sort of the notion of a state of siege. There was we heard a little bit from the testimony that the town, you know, there were all kinds of emergency alerts.
Yeah, I mean, I don't think this is unique to what happened at Kent. I feel like this is the typical government response to government mistakes. They immediately, instead of trying to look for the actual causes, they blame the victims. They tell terrible stories about them. They create rumors about snipers. I mean, this happened at Kent, and this continues to happen again and again.
And this notion of creating a truth commission to allow people who were witnesses to bear witness publicly. What about that is important to you? What's at the core of that for you?
Well, many of the people that have come to speak to us and share their stories with us haven't spoken about their experience since the day that they witnessed.
Ever?
Ever.
Nobody asked?
Or maybe they weren't ready to share. Who knows? But it's been such a dramatically healing experience for the people that have been carrying this burden for so long. I mean, when you have an experience like this, it becomes one of the defining features of your life. And if there's no place for you to put that pain, it can be very destructive.
How can people tune in and listen?
Yeah, well, we'll be broadcasting live from 9 to 5 Pacific time on michaelmoore.com. So anyone can watch these live. And also, if you miss them live, we will be hosting them on our website, truthtribunal.org. So you can continue to watch them. I mean, what separates our archive and what we're creating from past archives is that it's actually completely available and accessible to the public. We're putting out there information, and people can listen to all sides and find the truth for themselves. We're finally exposing all of these perspectives in a way that people have not had access to previously.
You know, I'm always interested in sort of the libraries of the books full of what people didn't say, you know, either because they didn't have the chance, they didn't have the words at the time, or they were afraid, or maybe they thought nobody would care. And this is sort of a library full of those books. And I guess I want to come back to you this way, Laurel Krauss. Could you talk a little bit about, I mean, it changed your life in that you lost your sister. How else did this reverberate through your entire life?
Well, my father, Arthur Krauss, took up the baton at the next day after Allison was killed and started legal proceedings, wishing to find out what happened. It was immediate. What happened? And for the next 9 years, almost 10 years, he pursued it. In trying to sue the state of Ohio, you have to have the permission of the state, and they wouldn't give it. So we had to go all the way to the U.S. Supreme Court to get that right. And we did. And so then you start over. And in that case, we didn't win. And then it was appealed. And so finally, at the ninth year, the Ninth Circuit, we got a statement of regret and $15,000.
A statement of regret.
And the day after the regret was issued, which was signed by all the guardsmen on that hill, my father made sure that was, they had to sign their name. One of the top National Guardsmen said it wasn't an apology immediately after they issued it.
Did you ever talk to any of these guardsmen?
Yes.
And what was that like?
It was recent. I'm calling them. It's a respectful call.
You're calling them to let them know that you're taking testimony?
Yes.
Maybe they want to give testimony.
The fellow that I called is not ready yet, but I am calling.
And what's the response when you explain who it is on the phone calling?
A little bit of a thud, mostly. But I immediately back it up and I say that I'm not wishing to disturb them or and that I am calling with respect because I am respecting them. All the people on all sides were caught in a bad situation, and I don't, you know, it still hurts that they pulled the triggers, and a lot of the guys that were there did not pull the trigger.
We don't know because enough pulled the triggers that it was a firing squad.
It was 13 seconds and 67 shots. Some might have gone into the ground. Some, I'm not sure. I don't know. I wasn't there. But it was difficult for everybody. And it will be a healing situation for a National Guardsman as well as a protesting student. The craw in my throat, it has more to do with the deflection that happened afterwards, which had to do with this ludicrous claim of there wasn't an order to shoot. In military actions, there is an order to shoot. This was military. This was the militia. And if there's not an order to shoot, then there's a court-martial or some sort of statement related to command responsibility. None of that has taken place here.
And what do you hope to come out of this? What do you want to see? Is there something you would like to see come out of this?
I'd like the truth to be known in 2010.
And Emily Kunstler, what is the, is there... I mean, I know there's no statute of limitations on murder and on killing. Is there any chance that this could be found as an unlawful, or we've already been through the legal proceedings and this is just for the public's eye?
Well, I think Laurel wanted to take this one.
Well, I mean, let's take a look at Bloody Sunday. Okay, that just happened June 15th, and there was an apology from David Cameron, Prime Minister, to Parliament, apologizing for an act where, you know, 1972 demonstrators, that most of them shot in the back when they were running away by the British paratroopers. There was a statement of apology that was very heartfelt by the President, the Prime Minister of the UK, and he took full responsibility for it. I hope everyone goes and looks at that YouTube. It's at our website at truthtribunal.org. If you go to the press page, you can watch him apologize. That's somewhere where what I want, at least.
We should say that there's nothing punitive about what we're doing. We're not trying to punish anyone. We're just trying to get the truth. We know that National Guardsmen might feel hesitant about participating because they might be implicating themselves criminally, and we're concerned about that. But that is not our interest. More than that, we're interested in getting the truth out and ultimately of the government taking responsibility, because it was, you know, it's individuals pulled the trigger, but they were responding to orders. So we would like to see accountability held on a much higher level.
Let's listen to Bill Kunstler.
Now a gymnasium covers part of that hill, and it is a shame. There should be a monument there.
This is Bill Kunstler.
It was a place where American patriots lived and died on May 4th, 1970. It was a place where young blood was shed by people no older than themselves. It was a place of tragedy, and yet out of it sprang a revulsion around this country that caused the closing of most of the institutions of higher education, that really brought an end to that ghastly war, if you can call it a war, in Southeast Asia. The four who died here, the nine who were wounded here, the many who faced a Portage County grand jury and petty jury, they did more for their country than all the Nixons and the Agnews and the Reagans could possibly do. 1977, we came back on May 4th, and it was a bad day as far as the weather was concerned.
It rained heavily, and so we moved inside to the Memorial Gymnasium. And on the platform sat two men, each in a wheelchair. There was Ron Kovic, a Vietnam veteran who was paralyzed from the waist down after stepping on a mine in Vietnam. And there was Dean Kaler, a student at this university, who was paralyzed for life by a National Guardsman's bullet. And toward the end of the services, Ron Kovic wheeled his wheelchair over to that of Dean Kaler. And these two men embraced each other with the tears rolling down their cheeks. And Ron Kovic said, and I will never forget the words, and there are people here who will remember them too, "Today at last, Kent State and Vietnam are united as one."
I'm Eric Klein, reporting for Flashpoints on Pacifica Radio. Last week, a Texas mosque was the target of an arson attack coupled with hate graffiti. The attacker spray-painted an image of Uncle Sam sexually assaulting Allah in the mosque parking lot. Mustafa Carroll is the executive director of the Council on American Islamic Relations, CARE, Texas.
The cause for alarm was that he wrote this ugly thing that about Allah and a picture of a dog and some other things, some really ugly graphic stuff.
Days later, in a separate incident, someone pulled pipes out of an outside wall of the mosque that they may have believed were gas lines. They were not. And then set fire to a nearby children's play structure belonging to the Dar el Imam Islamic Center of Arlington, Texas. Again, Mustafa Carroll.
Why would you burn down the children's stuff? I guess that's the only thing he saw he could set on fire. I don't know, but it's a bad tone to it.
While up-to-date scientific data is hard to come by, the Council on American Islamic Relations sees anecdotally that hate crimes against the Islamic community in the United States are on the rise. Just in the past few weeks, a mosque in Jacksonville, Florida was firebombed, and a mosque in Maryland was attacked with hate graffiti. The leader of the Arlington, Texas mosque has speculated that the anger is centered around the controversy with the proposed expansion of an existing Islamic center in New York City, near Ground Zero. Again, CARE Texas's Mustafa Carroll.
This is a pattern that we're starting to see all over the United States. It's not just in Texas, but you have some issues there in California. In Florida, they're having to burn the Quran Day. I mean, these types of incidents. And whenever one group may be a little less harmful than the next, but whenever you have an anti-movement, as it were, you have a kaleidoscope of different personalities who all hear different things. Some people say, oh, we're just going to protest because we want to get against any radicalization or whatever. You got some people who just, it's all Muslims and we need to get rid of them and I'm going to go do X, Y, Z. So the language and the incidents that we're seeing is setting a pattern throughout the nation, and we would like for law enforcement to step up a patrol around areas where they know the masjid exists or Muslims exist, etc. Because this type of language is sometimes a preface to what might happen, could turn violent.
Carroll says that Arlington police reacted well to the incident, and that the mosque that was attacked has a positive relationship with their local law enforcement. And while CARE is seeking the help of the FBI to protect the Muslim community in the United States from hate crimes, there is a potential conflict there. Vinu Dubal is a staff attorney with the Asian Law Caucus in the San Francisco Bay Area.
We had a surge of clients come to us who have complaints about the FBI visiting them in their mosques, the FBI coming to community events, the FBI coming to their businesses in the middle of the workday, frequently, not just once or twice, but, once a week, to ask them questions that are sometimes very mundane and sometimes very explicitly about their religious practice or about other people in their mosque.
The Asian Law Caucus is partnering with the ACLU to seek more information from the FBI on their new program to map U.S. communities based on race, religious, and ethnic makeup. The existence of said program and its guidelines were revealed in an earlier Freedom of Information Act request.
What we learned is that basically the guidelines open up the door for racial and ethnic profiling. Specifically, they open the door for mapping, geo-mapping Muslim communities based on things like lifestyle characteristics, based on where they vacation, based on the charities they donate to, based on the food that they eat, really kind of trying to gather intelligence on everything that the Muslim communities in the United States sort of engages in, which is, you know, goes far above the call of investigating counterterrorism threats, and goes dangerously into violating people's constitutional rights.
Mustafa Carroll of CARE Texas said he would like it if the FBI worked to protect the Islamic community, but instead, they seem to be sowing distrust.
That's where we have some trepidation about even calling them, because once you ask for their involvement, then they get into this, well, what mosque you go to, and what do they teach in there, and all this type of stuff, you know, and none of those questions are legitimate, you know, questions. I mean, if you want to find some people who do bad deeds, generally are not that religious. And that was the profile that the FBI even had with the 9/11 folks.
The Asian Law Caucus's staff attorney, Vina Dubal, with some details of the FBI's troubling interactions with the Bay Area's Islamic community.
In the East Bay, there's a charter school that has something like 90% of the students Muslim because it's an Arabic immersion charter school. We know that the FBI regularly visits the school. Regularly comes to school events and talks to parents at these school events, sort of in an educational setting, a place where, you know, the FBI really has no reason or place to be present and is really intimidating people in this particular safe space, this educational context. We know also that the FBI has been covertly present at even secular community events. So, for example, there was a very famous Muslim playwright, Wahajat Ali, who writes on post 9/11 experiences in the Muslim community. He came and gave a talk somewhere in the Oakland area talking about civil liberties violations. And lo and behold, we were told by community members that the FBI was present. And the reason that they knew that the FBI was present covertly was because agents that had visited them in their businesses, so agents that they were able to recognize as FBI agents, were also in the audience. So we know, and the community really knows, that they are under a state of siege, a state of surveillance, and it's having a huge impact on people's abilities to associate with one another, their First Amendment rights to freedom of religion, their First Amendment right to freedom of association are all being impinged upon. We know from mosque leaders that there's a general feeling that mosque attendance is down, that people are afraid to attend mosque services because they're worried that somehow this will mark them as a religious Muslim and that the FBI will then be after them as well.
Both Mustafa Carroll of CARE Texas and Vina Dubal of the Asian Law Caucus think that the FBI's misguided attention towards the Islamic community at large sends a potentially dangerous message to those extremist Americans who might be roused to acts of hate and violence.
When the FBI is targeting a particular community, particularly when they target this community by going to public places, by going to mosques, by going to school events, by going to places of work, they send the message to the larger American public that the Muslim community is disloyal and suspicious. The government thinks that this community is disloyal and suspicious, and therefore it's okay for you to think that as well.
For Flashpoints Up Front, I'm Eric Klein. That wraps it up for the Best of Flashpoints this week. Thanks for listening.